Welcome back to Shatteringness. We've been, over these last few weeks, studying the story that the Torah tells of the flood and of Yahweh choosing Noah because he was upright in his family, because he walked with Yahweh. Noah was considered righteous, and his family with him as a result of this. And we talked about how the ark represents the covenant and how Yahweh affirmed this, saying that he is establishing his covenant with Noah, and that the reason that Noah was accepted within the covenant is the example he set within his family and his walk with God, which tells us a great deal about how we, too, can participate in the covenant and receive Yahweh's protection. This is particularly germane at this time because we are about to enter a period of human history that is vastly more vile and corrupt, vastly more deadly, with storms eminently more ruthless and vicious than what Noah endured. And just as Noah's ark was the only means of salvation, of safety, of protecting a family in the midst of this in the region of Mesopotamia, so too will Yahweh's covenant be the only ark of protection for those on the cusp of the tribulation, those of us living today. Within 20 years, it's all going to be over. Yahweh will have returned. All the religious and political influences will be eliminated. Some 90% of the people currently alive on this planet will have died. The earth during the 5 days between Yom Kippurim and Sukkah and year 6000 Yah, which is 2033 on our pagan calendars, all of the earth is going to be cleansed as it was during the flood. At least in the flood, it was the portion from eastern Turkey down to the mouth of the Tigris-Euphrates River. No, this time it's going to be the entire earth, with the entire planet turned into the conditions that were experienced in the Garden of Eden. It's going to be made perfect. And we're going to get to camp out with our God for 1,000 years. Now, that time is just 20 years from now. A lot is going to go bad between now and then. The storms are going to be intense, both actual storms, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes, but also all forms of human malfeasance, famines, pandemics, terrorism, propaganda, and the carnage of wars. All of it is going to transpire. Well, as we were considering the covenant that Yahweh created with Noah, and whether or not this story was a story of legend, a flood legend like some of the others, or whether this was history told for us for a reason and told to us so that we might understand the nature of Yahweh's covenant and how to participate in it, the importance of family relative to the covenant, we find overwhelming proof for exactly what God described. His account says that the flood will begin with an upwelling of deep ocean water, and that is exactly what occurred. The Burkle Crater now affirms this. We find, too, that he defines the area of the flood as inundating those who had a Nesoma, which would have been Homo sapiens east of Eden, which was in eastern Turkey, down through the Tigris and Euphrates valleys. And we were considering yesterday the discovery of Robert Ballard, of Titanic fame, who just 4 days from September 11th, 2001, was leading a research team of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania into the Black Sea. They were searching for the world's oldest civilization, alleged to be buried beneath the sea shores, 500 feet below the surface and 12 miles off the current Turkish coast. A multitude of artifacts were found, including collapsed structures, homes and buildings of all kinds, tools and carved beams, Of course, they were very well preserved because there was no oxygen down in the deep water, at least no free oxygen. Water itself is comprised of oxygen. The scientific team identified these as evidence of an antediluvian civilization. Antediluvian means pre-flood. They knew that there was a flood of biblical proportions in this area. The evidence is the transformation of the Black Sea from fresh to salt water in an instant, and the fact that these civilizations are now 12 miles a sea and 500 feet below the surface of the existing waters as they are now. So along this ancient coastline, Ballard found two types of shells. One group was an extinct freshwater mollusk dating back 7,000 years. The other was a saltwater species which emerged circa 4,000 BCE. There was a sudden and dramatic shift from freshwater to saltwater that was the result of a massive flood. A vast amount of land which was inhabited was submerged. Those are Ballard's words. It was a sudden, dramatic shift from a freshwater lake to a saltwater sea that was the result of a flood. A vast amount of land, land which was inhabited, was submerged, end quote. Detko Slovakov, a member of Ballard's team from the Bulgarian Oceanographic Institute, said, and I quote, "Organic sediment from the ecological catastrophe has been found, which dates back to the time of the flood attributed by the Bible," end quote. He added, quote, "The world's oldest tombs, dating back to 4,000 to 4,500 BCE, are found here. And these 294 tombs contain over 3,000 gold objects, among them many, catch this, religious icons," end quote. You see, for those who are religious, the mention of religious icons says, oh, these people were religious, they were faithful, they were good, they were seeking to know God. Those who know God know that the presence of religious icons means that they were repulsive, that they were leading people away from God, that they were damned by God, which means forsaken by God. Those of us who know Yahweh as he is, for having discovered him in his Torah, know that this discovery of many religious icons among the dead along the shores of the Black Sea, as it existed at the time of the flood, affirms Yahweh's evaluation of these people. He said they were corrupt, they were lifeless, they were disgusting. And we know that it is religion, particularly when it is married with politics, as was the case here, that is the most deadly and terroristic combination, toxic brew, ever conceived by man. These religious icons are the oldest in the world, and they are right where God told us they would be. The same oceanographer said, "I have inspected some of these as they are in display in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, Russia. They depict the same sun god images, including Taurus the bull and circular halos that were ultimately manifest in the Babylon religion. Those religious images are no different than the religious icons we find buried in Babylon. They even celebrate Taurus the bull. Taurus the bull is where the sun crosses on the Sunday that is now called Easter. It's based on Taurus the bull. It's why God was so angry with the Israelites for building the golden bull as a religious image at the foot of Mount Horeb while he was revealing the Torah. This fascination with the bull as the power and the horns of the bull, particularly as the sun crosses the constellation of Taurus during the spring equinox, which is when all these pagan religions claimed that their god, the sun, impregnated Mother Earth, the goddess, giving birth 9 months later on what we now celebrate as Christmas, on the winter solstice, as the day that the Son of the Sun is born. It is the model of Christianity, all manifest in these religious icons, predating the flood. Of significant relevance, the Black Sea is the world's largest inland body of water, encompassing 168 square miles. It is the reservoir of Noah's flood. Back then, it was 500 feet shallower. It was fresh, albeit landlocked. Today, at the vastly higher mean water level, it is a narrow channel through which the Bosphorus Straits runs to the Aegean Sea. What's particularly interesting about the Black Sea is that it is comprised of a single basin or bowl, which lies 6,000 to 7,200 feet below sea level. Central and Eastern Europe, much of Russia, and large areas of Turkey all drain into what is the largest inland water receptacle in the world. And let us not forget the neighboring Caspian Sea. It is considered to be the world's largest inland body of water. Without an outlet, it runs 750 miles north and south and 250 miles laterally southeast of the area we are discussing. Its surface is 100 feet below sea level, and its depths plunge 550 feet below that. This 143 square mile saltwater ocean is bordered by the Elbutz and the Caucasus Mountains. Now, when we return to Shattering Mists after the commercial break, we will consider to find more affirming evidence that Yahweh told us the truth some thousands of years ago. Welcome back to Shattering Mists. I am your host, Yada. You can participate in this program at any time by calling 877-300-7645. After examining the evidence, both from the Torah and scientific, and putting the pieces together, it is apparent that Yahweh triggered the flood with an asteroid strike. The impact would have caused catastrophic flooding with monstrous tsunami waves, roaring up the mouths of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, eventually reaching their headwaters near Lake Van. It would have instantly killed everything in its wake. The impact could well have loosened the underground cisterns of water, exacerbating the problem. The heat generated from the initial blast would have melted mountainous ice packs in the region and generated massive mud flows. As a direct result of water and debris being hurled into the atmosphere, these catastrophic events would have been followed by torrential rains, not just in the area but around the globe. Eventually, the rain would turn to snow, especially in the higher elevations. Every place on Earth would have been deluged to one extent or another. Now, and because Yahweh chose the timing of this, well, I do not see Yahweh often engaging to control natural events. I think he did the same thing here that he is saying that he is going to do with Asbestos in the years to come. In the midst of the tribulation in 2029, Friday, April 13th, when Asbestos, MN 2004, using the scientific nomenclature, is expected to pass within 15,000 miles of the Earth, Yahweh says he's going to see that it's nudged. Now, he can nudge it in any manner of ways, and it doesn't take much for that 15,000-mile difference to be an impact. Such was the case here. I don't know the nature of this asteroid. And obviously, it didn't have a name unless Yahweh chose to provide it one, and he certainly did not share that name with us. But the same thing's going to happen in our future, less than 20 years from now. In fact, 16 years from now, we're going to experience a similar event. I suspect that when Espenthos strikes, that it will be in the Atlantic Ocean because of the description of what follows, the destruction of the world's merchant fleets, the destruction of so much of the belligerent world. You know, a strike in the Atlantic would do a number of things. It would cause the volcanic island that is off the coast of Spain that right now has a fissure under it that is just awaiting a triggering event to slide a whole half of a mountain into the sea, which would create an enormous tsunami, and so would this asteroid strike. The east coast of the United States would be wiped out. Most of Western Europe. Instantly. Andy, we're talking about a wall of water, not 10 feet tall, which Tacloban strike with the hurricane, the cyclone, as it's called in that part of the world, was a 10-foot wall of water. We're talking about a wall of water that will be in the thousands of feet. And it is in our near future. If you want protection from this, if you don't want to endure it, there is an answer. It was provided by Yahweh when Noah chose to engage with Yahweh, follow his guidance, and he built the ark with Yahweh. Well, that ark has now been built. It's called the covenant. You can participate in it, but you do have to engage. You have to follow God's directions just as Noah did. But that is what happened then. It is what is going to happen in our future. I think the flood was a global event, only in the sense that an asteroid strike of that size then, as will the asteroid strike that is predicted by Yahweh on April 13th, a Friday, in 2029, just as it is predicted then, the strike then will be both a regional and worldwide event. Yes, it precipitated the exact flood of the welling up of deep ocean water through eastern Turkey all the way down to the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and reshaped that part of the world, leaving a lasting legacy for us to identify. But a strike of that magnitude changes the weather dramatically around the world, just as will this one, which is why Yahweh says that the skies will be opaque prior to his return. The sun and the moon will no longer be seen because of the debris that will be cast into the atmosphere. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering This. So while the flood was a global event, although only this area that Yahweh targeted was received the bulk of the deluge, the epicenter was Lake Van. The floodwaters there were the deepest. They prevailed there the longest, approximately 150 days, at a depth of about 4,000 cubits, or just shy of 7,000 feet. If we ascribe a radius of 250 miles to this basin, no one aboard a ship floating therein would have been able to see land in any direction, especially considering the elevated humidity. And no non-migratory bird, like a raven or a dove, would have been able to reach any of the surrounding snow-covered peaks in return. That said, I have no way of knowing if the volcanic ranges, as they appeared at that time, would have retained this depth of water, or if Yahweh performed a miracle akin to parting the Red Sea, Gulf of Aqaba, during the Exodus. While the underwater land bridge at the Israelites' most likely crossing site requires holding back two 1,000-foot deep walls of water for 29 miles. The gulf plummets to 5,000 feet in depth on either side. So since Exodus was similar to the deluge in that one group of people were saved while another were drowned, and since it was miraculously performed, there is no need to roll out godly intervention with regard to the water management issue in Noah's case. Moving outward toward the Black and Caspian Seas, the damage in this larger basin would have been considerable. The waters may have risen as much as 1,000 feet and may have retained that level for 4 to 6 months. The heavy and continuous downpour triggered by the asteroid strike would have made this possible, especially since these massive basins serve as the watersheds for most of Europe and Russia. The whole Middle Eastern basin would have been influenced by this event, both coming and going. Mesopotamia was the first landmass submerged by the 1,000-foot-high walls of water that were emanating from the asteroid's plunge into the sea. And the Tigris and Euphrates were also there to provide the drainage for the epicenter of the flood, which was zeroed in at their headwaters. The consequence of this cataclysmic event would have been felt for several months throughout the enormous basin. The waters would have been as deep would not have been as deep, though, going all the way down the rivers or have endured as long, but the amount of sediment we now find at the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates that was all laid down at one time at this time is evidence of them providing this drainage. While the world's climate would have been altered for at least a month after the asteroid strike, it's hard to quantify, the amount of additional rain which would have fallen. But we can surmise that snowpacks would have melted initially, at least partially, causing massive flooding in certain areas, and the rains which would have followed the impact would have been torrential. It's very much like the nuclear winter following an atomic assault. Therefore, in conclusion, we know with absolute certainty that a flood of Torah proportions occurred when and where and how God described it. There were early civilizations exactly where he said they would be, and the topography uniquely facilitated the event that Yahweh described. The evidence, scientific and archaeological, as well as from the Torah, is in complete accord because Yahweh was a witness to these events, and he provided his witness to us. Now, there are a few loose ends that I'd like to tie up before we leave the deluge and move on to the story of Abraham and the formation of the covenant that Yahweh first discussed with Noah. In Bereshith 8:1, we read, "The Almighty remembered and proclaimed the truth about Noah." And that is because Noah remembered God, God remembered him. You know, if you walk with God, if you set an example within your family that is consistent with God's presentation of his covenant in the Torah, then it becomes evident to God that you have prioritized him and his family in your family and in your life. And if you walk with him, he will return the gesture and will walk with you. To know God is to be known by God. Now, God does not have to tell us that he proclaimed the truth about Noah now because of the investigations that have been done relative to the Burkle Crater, relative to the settlements in Ur, relative to the civilizations in the Black Sea, relative to the change of salt to fresh water in that area and the rise of its surface waters, we know that he was telling the truth. It happened exactly as he said. We've even found Noah's Ark. You can use Google Earth to view it yourself. We know these things now, so God does not need to tell us that he told us the truth about them. But he did. And the reason is that for, I think, two causes. One is that prior to having some of this information, it would have been, we'd be taking God on his word. You know, was this a truthful account or was this a fable? You know, God can tell a story. He's told parables. And, you know, a parable is a story that is used to convey a message, something that's important for you to understand that through the word picture, that example, the story that is being told becomes easier to understand. And so the Noah account could well have been, God would not have been out of line to say, you know, this is the story. I want you to appreciate what it means to be excluded from the covenant, which is to die, and to be protected by my covenant as a family, my family, and live. And that the difference between one of the two is those who walk with me, those who act appropriately within their own families, those who pay attention and act upon my advice, my guidance, are those who are protected, those who do not die. That would have been a fine story. But God said, no, I told you the truth about this. This isn't. It's just a story. It's real. It happened. It's the same thing with the children of Yisrael as they were saved by Yahweh from the crucible of Egypt, the crucible of human, religious, and political, military, and economic oppression. It's a real story. It actually happened. It's a historical event. God engaged in their lives and saved them. And he saved them the very same way he saves us, all of the children of the covenant, through Passover and matzah. And Mukurim, firstborn children, leading to Shavua. Same events are foreshadowed in this episode with Noah. I'm quite certain that he boarded this great vessel around Passover, that they celebrated matzah and Mukurim in this vessel, and that when they emerged on dry land again, it was Shavua. And that's when the rainbow of the covenant was on display. So God told us the truth. He's saying this is a true story. It's not a legend. It's not a myth. This is not a parable. This is real. You'll find verification for it. But you need to take it to heart, because what I told you is the truth. Also, in the same verse, you'll find the Spirit of the Almighty, which passed over the earth, caused the waters to abate. Passed over. Abar. Abar is the basis of Pesach. Passover. The concept is the same, to pass over. He passed over Noah and his family. He will pass over the covenant family. Passover means that we, as children of the covenant, Noah as a child of the covenant and his family, did not die. They were protected. They were passed over for death. Death is part of our mortal nature. But God can choose to pass over death, to eliminate death for those who embrace his guidance regarding life. That's what he did with Noah and the ark. He said, the Spirit of the Almighty, which passed over the earth, caused the waters to abate. It's the Spirit of Yahweh that protects those of us who embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. We are protected by Yahweh's Spirit. Just as they were protected not only in the ark, but by Yahweh's Spirit. And this is an affirmation also that I was right, that the commencing event was Passover. Noah and his family had been passed over as a prophetic example of what would happen in Egypt at the genesis of the Exodus. The ark was a symbol for Yahweh's set-apart spirit protecting Noah during the storm. Now, searching for and finding Noah's ark seems to be more captivating to people than searching Yahweh's word to find God, even to find useful instruction on how to participate in this covenant that he had established through this story. Countless people have mounted expeditions to Mount Ararat, and even more have scoffed at them. So that we don't leave this stone unturned, let's consider what Yahweh revealed in this regard. The ship, the ark, the Tabah, came to rest Nuach in the seventh month of the 17th day of the month among the mountains of Ararat. All right, so it is al, which means on, near, close to, toward, in proximity to, or among. Doesn't say that it came to rest on the summit of Ararat. And perfectly good Hebrew word for summit. It's Rosh. Part of the first word of the Torah. In fact, we're reading this from Bereshith, which is based upon the concept, in fact, the word etymology of Rosh. But he didn't say, you're going to find this ark on the summit of this volcanic mountain. No, he said it would be among the mountains of plural, the Herei, the hills or ridges of Ararat. We'll return to this statement after the commercial break. Well, welcome back to the final segment of our program today. The last statement we read has much in it worth our consideration. It said that the ship, or the ark, the Tabah, came to rest Nuach in the seventh month, a Kodesh time of renewal. Nuach is a very, very revealing term. Now, we just recognize that Yahweh spoke about how his spirit, the spirit of the Almighty, is what caused the waters to abate, and did so through the process of Passover. Well, Nuach is the term that actually explains the Spirit's work and God's intent relative to the Shabbat, which, if you'll notice here, it says it's Ha Teba Nuach Shabbai, the seventh, speaking of seven, which is the basis of Shabbat. What Nuach says to us regarding the Shabbat is that it is God's intent for him to settle our debts on this day so we can settle down with him. And he expressly explains the Shabbat using Nuach. So the Shabbat isn't a day that we're just idle, that we don't do anything, but a day instead where Yahweh is telling us that he doesn't want us to work for our salvation, that he himself is going to settle our debts so that we can settle down with him, and that this is what we celebrate relative to the Shabbat. It's God's idea of perfection, of man conceived on the sixth day, plus God who is one, equating it to God's idea of perfection, which is us being together, being seven, Shabbat. And so here, Nuach and Shabbai, which is the promise of seven, is being juxtaposed, one word to the next, with the following word being Kodesh, which is renewal. So our renewal as a result of Yahweh taking this protective enclosure of the covenant, here portrayed by the Teba, the Ark, and using it to settle us based upon his promise of seven, renewing us so that we can live with him. That's the purpose of all of this. And he's doing it within a family construct. So if you examine the words, if you are observant here, and you let your eyes travel back in time to what God is communicating to us, he's explaining the purpose of the Shabbat, reinforcing the importance of seven, reinforcing the whole concept of renewal of his promise to us, which is to Nuach, have his spirit, settle our debts so we can settle with him, so that we are protected by the Ark of the Covenant. Now, that's the first part of that. That's the message that is so essential to our salvation. But it's not the part of it that will help us understand where the ark would be found. Because Yahweh does not say that you're going to find the ark, as so many explorers have looked for it, at the summit of Mount Ararat. By the way, from a hydrology point of view, it would be impossible. If you, for example, if you do what was done to find the ark by the individual, Ron Wyatt, that found it, and you conduct you make a model that shows the volcanic range of Ararat, or really any mountain range, and you flood an area with water, and then you allow the water to reside, and you put a vessel on it. Make the vessel the same dimensions as the ark and the same scale, just for interest here. And you do that, what you will find is that while the summit of the mountain would be the highest point, it's impossible to have the ship come down on that spot, to settle on that spot, because of the way that the water flows away from the mountains. It is literally taken away from the highest spot. That's why God said it's not on the summit. It's among the mountains of Ararat. And by doing this hydrology experiment in a flume of sorts, Ron Wyatt was the first to say, oh, I shouldn't be looking for it on Ararat, because that's impossible. I should be looking for it in the mountains of Ararat, on the hills and ridges of Ararat. And that's indeed where he found it. And that's where, on our program tomorrow, first thing, we will jump right back in and explain where the ark is and how you too can view it for your own affirmation.